executive secretary for the Division of Wildlife here for the RAC.
Tim Ignacio for the Ute Indian Tribe.
David Gordon, BLM.
Very good. Okay, this evening what we will do is go through the agenda and the minutes, if I call for an approval of the minutes.
I motion we approve the minutes.
Okay, it has been motioned. Do I have a second?
I second it.
It has been moved and seconded.
There's no second on that? There's no voting. It's just, it's been approved. Mm-hmm. You just go with the...
Okay. Excellent. The Wildlife Board meeting, unfortunately, I was not available to attend. However, Mr. Blackwell stood in for us, so if we can get an update of the Wildlife Board meeting for you, sir.
Yeah, you bet. Everything that this region recommended to the Wildlife Board was approved and accepted as we presented or requested. There were a few other changes. I have not received all of those notes or those minutes yet from Salt Lake, and so I can't go over those. But I can tell you that everything that this RAC recommended was passed.
Okay. Excellent. So, do we have any questions regarding the Wildlife Board meeting? Okay. In that case, we'll move on to the regional update.
For the regional update, I wanted to do something a little bit different. So I've asked Miles Hanberg if he wouldn't step in and give us a presentation regarding our habitat section and what our habitat section has done this year. So he's going to give a brief update on that, rather than going over the minor details of a lot of the other things. We'll just go with Miles and his habitat.
I'll try to keep it brief. I could spend hours, but there's a lot to could show you, but anyhow, we do a lot of work under the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative, as well as the Habitat Council programs in Utah. As you all know, sage grouse is a big issue, and trying to prevent sage grouse from being listed, we're aggressively improving habitat for sage grouse. Our mule deer numbers are down statewide, and so we're really trying to do additional work to help our mule deer, and then we also have other wildlife that are priorities. And so I'll kind of go over some of the things we've been up to this fiscal year and some of the projects that we're doing to try to accomplish some of those goals as well as others. This is just a map of our region. The color-coded polygons you can see on there are kind of small, but that's all the projects that we're working on this fiscal year 14, starting in July and ending next end of June next year. So we've covered quite a few acres this year, and it's really pretty well distributed across the region, but a lot of those areas represent sage grouse habitat as well as important deer and elk wind ranges as well. So anyhow, kind of a list of projects. I don't know if you guys can see that very well, but this is the amount of projects, the list of the projects we're working on this year. To date, this fiscal year, we've completed 9,283 acres, and we've got 4,064 acres that we're still implementing that we hope to have done in the spring. So, would you guys like to kind of go down through the list and kind of have an explanation what everything is, or? Yes, no? Well, I'll go down it anyways. First one at the top is Little Mountain Lop and Scatter, Phase 1. This is out at the base of Little Mountain, just here west of Vernal. It's intended to help sage grouse. Once we get pinyon juniper growing in sagebrush, sage grouse start to leave and don't use the habitat anymore. So a lot of these projects are intended to remove conifer from sage grouse habitat. The second one on the list is Anthro Mountain PJ Treatment. That is a bullhog project actually out in the Big Wash area. And so we're looking at doing about 400 acres out there. That's under contract right now. And so as soon as the contractor finishes another project, they'll be moving out there probably in January. So Marshall Draw and Warren Draw, Lop and Scatter, this is up on Diamond Mountain. Some areas where sage grouse as well as some important big game ranges where we're just looking to take out those small trees. We completed that. It was 946 acres. We did a big maintenance of our chains that we've completed over in the Tabby Mountain area since 2004. And so we did 1916 acres where we just came in and took out the little trees that were starting to come back in there and prolong the life of those chains. The upper Anthro Lop and Scatter, that's again on Anthro Mountain on the top on Forest Service lands. We're planning to do 721 acres, and again, that's to improve habitat for sage grouse. The Park Ridge Bullhog Maintenance, this is up in the Book Cliffs, areas where we've done a lot of bullhog work, and we just have little trees coming back in. The thing with bullhogs is they miss the little, real small trees, less than like a foot. It's really hard to get all those. So let's go back in and take those out and make sure that the life of those projects are extended. Bullworm Wyaska Bottom, this is on Ore National Wildlife Refuge, and they've been working to control Russian olive and tamarisk down there. And so they've got a project right now that we're working with them on that's 332 acres to clean up some of those weedy brush species. We also did a phase two project on Little Mountain, up on the top of Little Mountain. That was 472 acres. That was up on some silt land up near the towers where we do have some of the sage grouse leks and the nesting habitat up on Little Mountain. We worked with the Forest Service on timber stand improvement along Highway 191 north of Vernal. If you've been up through there near Grizzly Ridge, you'll see a lot of lodge poles have been thinned and some of those really dense stands. So that did a good job about opening up some of those. That was 328 acres, and that's done. Just last week, we finished a bullhog in on Moonshine Ridge in the Book Cliffs. That's 350 acres. They just barely finished that up, so that was a pretty neat project. We're planning on doing some lock and scatter out on Steer Ridge in the Book Cliffs. This spring, that'll be 566 acres. We completed seeding of about 75 acres over in Sowers Canyon on the property held by Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. Hoping to improve some deer and elk habitat there. Jack Trap Canyon, that's another bullhog project out in the Book Cliffs. It's out on for bid right now, and it'll be 350 acres. And we're planning to get that done in the spring. We're doing some more maintenance on Indian Springs Ridge in the Book Cliffs and bullhog areas. Again, this is just cutting out those small trees. It's going to be 620 acres. The next two projects, we had the Tabby Browse Plots and Simplot Browse Plots up on the Simplot Phosphate Mine. Well, what we're really trying to do here is getting more browse species incorporated into some of the big vast areas of grass. And so I'll show some pictures of some of that here in a few minutes. But 80 acres over at Tabby and about 65 up at the Phosphate Mine. The next few projects, we worked with BLM on their fuels program. The first one was up in Dry Fork. It included a lot of country in the Little Mountain. That's 2,000 acres. And then up in Browns Park on Tolliver's, that's 216 acres of bullhog work and old pinyon juniper chainings to benefit deer. So the next table, we had several projects that we had to carry over for whatever reason. We had some lop and scatter out on Horse Ridge on the Vinequin. Some bullhogs projects in the Book Cliffs. We're actually in process on one in Pine Springs right now. And then this year, we just completed the chaining out on Moon Ridge in the Book Cliffs. They included some BLM land. It's one of the only green tree chainings on BLM land that we've completed in this region for probably 30, 40 years. So it was kind of exciting to do that. That was 920 acres. It's pretty impressive if you go out there, but it'll look really good, I think, here in the next couple of years. And then we're actually working right now up in Browns Park and Bake Oven Flat to restore some sagebrush up there. The next column of projects are projects that aren't really acreage, tied into acreage per se. They're less vegetation type treatments. I'll go down pretty quickly. We did some stream work up on Crouch Creek on Diamond Mountain to improve stream habitat. We've done some exclosures on aspen in the Book Cliffs, try to promote and protect aspen regeneration. Then we've done several wildlife guzzlers and water developments, some on Diamond Mountain in the Book Cliffs and up on Bear Top for our bighorn sheep, and some for pronghorn as well. And Then we also have some a project we're trying to get going this next year over at the Lower Stillwater to rejuvenate some of those ponds over there that have kind of silted in. So anyhow, that's kind of an overall list of all the projects that we're working on. It's a pretty aggressive list, and we've got many of those done already, so we're hoping to get those completed before our fiscal year closes out. This is just an example of one of the old guzzlers up on Bear Top that we replaced. Thing's been there for a long time, pretty dilapidated, and so wasn't working, had holes in the tank, so we decided, you know, we're just going to come in and rebuild that. We had some Eagle Scouts actually help on that project, and so we came in and replaced two of those up there. And they actually have water in them this fall. They ended up having water in them, and we got quite a bit of rain in when we had those rainy events there in October. So those are doing well. Out in the book list, we built four, and we fenced those out there. These are intended to help bison and elk and other things as well, and so we didn't really want a herd of buffalo going across the apron or anything like that, so we put in some fencing to, you know, protect those, but those all have water in them. We had elk and everything using those this fall as well. This picture shows Goslin. It's kind of hard to see the Goslin Mountain. We had a fire up there this fall, or this summer actually, and so tomorrow we're actually applying some seed on a couple hundred acres up there with the Forest Service, so that seed will go on tomorrow. This is an example of some of the work up at Crouch Creek on Diamond Mountain. We put in a lot of these rock sills, used a small track hole to work in that. It's a pretty small stream, but this picture on the right will show those rock sills that kind of help raise the water level. And then on the left, you can see on that bend where the channel is deepened, and then you can see a log there. And the log is a fish hotel. You basically put logs out over the stream and then put sod on top of it, and it creates kind of an undercut bank and shade and that for fish to hide underneath. So this was the third phase this year of Crows Creek, and it kind of finishes everything throughout the DWR land up there. So it's kind of a neat project to improve stream habitat for fish. This is an example of a bullhog mounted on a traco. We've had several of those types of projects this year, just to kind of give you guys an idea of what those look like. That's a traco. They're a little bit slower than some of the rubber tired machines. This is an example of what we typically bullhog. You call this a phase two pinyon juniper community. They've come in, they're getting fairly dominant. You're starting to reduce your understory vegetation. So something like this, we'll use a bullhog on to try to remove that. That's kind of what it looks immediately after. So it's at the exact same point we took that picture, but it really changes things. This is an example of one of the rubber tired machines. It has a big head on the front, and they'll mow a tree up in just a few seconds. So, and then the other thing is the anchor chaining. It's probably the most impressive of all of it. If you're out watching that, just two D8s and pull chains through there. We usually do it two passes to try to make sure we uproot all those trees. One thing we did this year, this is what we used on the Tabby Mountain project I mentioned to you, as well as the Simplot. Developed the scalper. It basically makes a furrow to remove the grass competition. And then within that furrow, we plant browse species. The crested wheatgrass we're seeding in is very, very competitive, and it doesn't allow anything else to establish in it without removing it. So we kind of make these furrows, plant the browse seed in the middle of those, and that removes the competition, gives it the advantage for the next year to grow its browse on these crucial deer winter ranges and safe grouse habitats. Now, this is an example we did up at the phosphate mine. So did quite a big area, and based on what we see next year, we'll likely do more. Just wanted to show you, this is what we've done since 2005 in the region of projects. So we've covered a big portion of the country out there, and it's really, like I say, tied to our crucial winter ranges and our sage grouse habitats. So it's been a pretty rewarding experience. But I wanted to show you this table. It kind of shows the number of acres we've treated by a wildlife management unit. Red line sticks over to the left. It sticks way up there. It's the Bitter Creek unit in the book list where we've completed, well, now I think over 50,000 acres. This is a little bit dated. But most of the units, about 15,000 or less. But what's kind of interesting with the next slide is you look at the percent area treated by a wildlife management unit, and ironically, the book list drops down to 3.5%. Our Little Creek is actually the highest because we had the big rattle fire come through there in 2000 and we seeded a number of those acres. So it actually turns out to be the highest percentage of any unit we've treated, but the three quarters is pretty high as well. So, you know, you look at these acreage figures and they're pretty impressive, but then you start putting in context, we've only treated, you know, on average 3 or 4% of our units. And so, you know, I think we're seeing some positive results, but, you know, likely we're going to have to do a significant amount more acreage to really make big differences and get the responses that we're looking for. I wanted to show you a couple more things briefly on another PowerPoint. This kind of gives you an example of what we're really trying to accomplish out there with some of these treatments. And these images are tied towards pinion and juniper a little bit more, but this is a project actually in 2004. It's one of our oldest projects, and this is a project as you go up Diamond Mountain, and so you call this like a stage 3 pinion and juniper community where you're really starting to lose all of your understory vegetation. The trees are getting big and dominant. There's not much there for wintering big game. It's not very good sage grouse habitat. But that's what it looked like in 2007, and so you can see just a tremendous amount of understory vegetation is present now. And again, that's taken right down the exact same line. So we really reduced our pinion juniper cover down to 0%, so it's had a good result as far as removing all the pinion juniper. And then if you look at our cover for our sagebrush, increased a bit from the original treatment, but we did establish a bunch of Wyoming sagebrush that wasn't originally there. So anyhow, this is another example. This is over Tabby Mountain area on the chaining project the same year. Again, you can see there, it's really bare ground. There's not much there for a deer or elk to eat. So it's pretty bare. We wanted to go in and try to get something else going there, and that's what it looked like in 2007. The chaining leaves a lot of trunks and things on the ground, but you can see it's growing a lot more vegetation there now than it was before. So it's actually wintering a lot of elk in that area now, and we do get a lot of deer use as well. But again, it has some data on there, but we really reduced our pinion juniper from 46% down to 0% on the cover. And we did seed some sagebrush and saw some good establishment in that. And especially if you look at it now, that those plants have now matured a great deal more, and we're seeing bigger and thicker sagebrush plants out on that site. So, yeah, I just kind of wanted to show you that to give you an idea of what we're really trying to accomplish with some of these treatments, and those are some that have been pretty successful. So, anyhow, any questions from anybody?
What does it take, about 3 years? It looks like you go back in about 3 years, and then you really see the difference.
Yeah. The first year, you don't really want to look, because some people could think something failed, but you go back a second or third, and it's, you look really good. So you got to give it a couple before you really want to make an assessment of success or failure.
You need about a three-year period to see how it's working out, don't you?
Yeah, and then the thing is, with our sagebrush and our browse plants, those things take decades really to establish real well. So we get initial responses with our grasses, and we can determine if we've got good establishment on our browse. But for those things to really reach the cover, especially in the lower elevations, we might be 20 to 30 years on some of those.
Mm-hmm.
The sagebrush in the mountain, that stuff comes back like that. But anything else?
What's the status of the sage hen in this area? As far as endangered or whatever you want?
The Fish and Wildlife Service has listed or determined that they were warranted for listing, but they precluded the listing. And I think that's up for review again in 2015 in September, I believe.
Is that the whole region?
That's range-wide for sage grouse, but throughout the west. So it's it's everywhere in the West, in Wyoming, Colorado, Utah. But we have our statewide sage-grouse management plan. We're the most aggressive state in the West as far as restoring habitat, improving habitat for sage-grouse. And so we're hoping all those measures will provide enough evidence that we're doing the right things for sage-grouse to preclude them from being listed. Hopefully range-wide, but at least in Utah, that would be good. So.
Miles, when did they let you start using chains again?
Well, this was the first project on BLM lands that we've done for years, but we've done a couple on burned areas. They've been kind of okay with doing it in burned areas, but we've been doing it on DWR land and state land since 2004. We've been doing projects.
I was a young feller back in the 70s. We chained a lot of Little Mountain stuff, and they made them quit. I was told they wouldn't let them do it anymore.
Slowly, things are coming back around. I think, we do avoid the arc sites and all those things now. And if we do all those types of things, it's coming around. And there's been a couple other projects in the state on BLM lands in southern Utah, so I think we're kind of getting back into using that. But some people, they just hear the word chain, and they instantly, become very uptight. And honestly, they cause less disturbance to some of the ground than some of the other treatments.
Aren't they cheaper?
They are.
In the long run,
yep.
Cover the country?
Yep.
Boy, just show them people some of the pictures before and after, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a lot different.
You don't kill the junipers and cedars. You go up them old chainings and they come back just as...
Yeah.
They come back.
You got to keep at them, or 20, 30 years, they're right back, so...
Okay, is that everything for the update, sir?
No.
Okay.
I also want to welcome Tim, our tribal representative, to the RAC. It's been a long time since we've had somebody from the tribe sitting on our RAC representing tribal interests, and we want you to know you're more than welcome here. We're glad to have you, and we'll work with you, and hopefully you'll enjoy your time with us. So. Now I'm done.
Okay. Excellent. If that's the case, we'll go ahead and move forward to agenda item number 5, R657-27, License Agent Procedures Rule Amendments by Mr. Fulgrave.
Thank you. My name is Phil Gray. I am the business analyst for the division out of the licensing section in the Salt Lake office. I'll be presenting for your consideration some rule changes to R657-27. Just to give you a little bit of background on this rule. This rule, so if anybody ever wants to become a license agent for us, so you can go into Walmart or Kent's Market or Sportsman's or little Bob's Bait Shop out in the middle of nowhere and buy any kind of license that we have for sale. This rule is the one that governs what they can and can't do, what we can and can't do, and how that whole relationship works. First of all, we'd like to do some minor housekeeping edits and corrections, change a few terms that were used inconsistently throughout the document. The major change that we want to do is we want to provide the division the authority to require what's called an ACH, or an automated clearinghouse, for payment of monies owed to the division. So you go to Bob's Bait Shop, you drop $30 on a combination license, $28.50 of that is supposed to come back to the division. That's the division's money. The agent gets to keep their 5% cut. And so this is just an automatic electronic means of transferring that money back to the division. We've asked that the wording that we put in the rule is that we may require it, not that we will require it. This gives us a little bit of latitude to work with some of those companies that may not be able to do that, aren't comfortable with doing it. Right now we have just over 300 agents across the state. About 170 of them use the ACH payment. The rest they'll send in a check every month. So it's about half and half of the number of agents that are using it, but the large lion's share of the money that's sent into the division every month is through the ACH method, because we have, the Walmarts and Smith's Market, Cabela's, Sportsman's, the ones that sell the huge lion's share of our licenses, all send the money in electronically. Next, we'd like to require that any license agent that is selling our licenses provide for their employees access to the utah.gov internet domain, any place that they're selling licenses. This grew out of some frustration that employees in some large chain stores were having, that they were selling our licenses, but somebody would come in to buy a deer tag for an area. They're not sure exactly which area it is, and the agent isn't able to look it up and find out either, because we don't publish those in a book anymore. It's available online only. A lot of our, well, all of our maps, all of our application guidebooks, our stocking reports, fishing reports. If somebody wanted to see where on the Strawberry River is hot right now, you go into one of these chain stores. They weren't able to look that up. So we've actually worked with one of the larger chains, Walmart. We've got them on board with this. They're happy to do it. When we first went to electronic license sales, they didn't even want to do that. They wanted to still handwrite the licenses. We actually had to fight with them to get them to go electronic to sell the licenses. And now they're willing to allow their employees access to all of our wildlife domains. So their employees have that information to give to our customers. I'd like to remove the language that allows the division to supply computer equipment. This was added into the rule when it was first introduced about 12 years ago when we went to an electronic license sales system. Computer equipment was very expensive then, so this was one little incentive to get agents to remain on and to get going with the electronic license issue. Since then, computers have come down drastically in cost. They don't cost near as much as they used to. As well, all of our current licensed agents already have a computer of some sort. That's the only way they can be an agent. You have to sell them online. You have to be able to have internet access. We haven't provided a computer to an agent in about 8 years, except for their first printer. We will provide that. We will continue to provide that. They're also asking to reduce the amount of time licensed agents are required to retain audit copies of the licenses they sell. So to give you an example here, here on the left we have a dummy combination license. You see down the bottom, that bottom third there that's highlighted in red, it has the customer's name, address, height, weight, date of birth. Everything that really could be used to steal your identity was right there in that bottom copy. These were put in a box. And right now, the law requires that the agents keep these for 12 months from the date of sale. We didn't really like the idea of 500,000 licenses sitting around in storerooms collecting dust for a year at a time. It was just a matter of time before somebody accidentally threw them away. They ended up in a dumpster behind a store, and we end up on the news. So what I've done is we've completely changed the template. The bottom copy now you see only has the customer ID number, the license permit number, the type of license, the cost, and the date it was sold. This secures things up incredibly. The customer ID is unique to every customer, but to get somebody's information with just that number, you have to access a secure database from a computer logged into the state network from a division office. So it greatly narrows down the ability for somebody to compromise somebody's information. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate that. Are there any questions from the rep? Okay, any questions from the public? Comments from the rep? Comments from the public? Unfortunately, we do not have a quorum tonight, so we are unable to vote on this agenda item. So I believe we just move forward with the agenda.
Yeah, you can have a recommendation that we can take forward to the Wildlife Board, but we wouldn't be saying approved per 5-6 or something like that, but it would be a recommendation if there's any.
Okay.
I recommend it goes forward.
Okay.
Support of it.
Is there anyone on the rec opposed to moving forward with this item? As such, the Northeastern Region Advisory Council would make a recommendation to the Wildlife Board, minus quorum, that they approve the agenda item as presented by the state. That being said, we'll move on to action item number 6.
Thank you.
Thank you. Which reads R657-60, Aquatic Invasive Species Rule Amendments by Mr. Jordan Nielsen.
Thank you. I'm Jordan Nielsen. I'm the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator. The main goal of the Aquatic Invasive Species Program is to keep species out of our state that are going to cause harm to our waterways. While it's good and great to keep them out of our state, it's even better to keep a larger vision and keep them out of the western United States. I'm fortunate enough to sit on a national panel where we work on these issues west-wide. The difficulty with working with a west-wide panel is every state has different laws and different rules that govern how we can do things as far as stopping boaters, how we can enforce our law, and what exactly we enforce. We need to have a consensus among the states so that a boater that gets checked in Utah is leaving our state, going to Wyoming or Montana or Idaho, has a similar experience wherever they go. The knowledge that they gain about invasive species here is applicable everywhere they go. That's difficult, so what we've done is we've met to try and find the low-hanging fruit where we can make changes and make our program similar. The first step in that we've identified is how we classify water bodies that have invasive mussels in them. Currently, we have a classification scheme that's written into rule. However, the method for declassifying that is not written into rule. So we have two classifications that are rule-bound. Detected or suspected, which lasts for 3 years, and then it steps down to a lower classification that we don't use in rule called inconclusive, and it stays there for 2 years before we take it off of the list. And we have infested, which stays at infested for 3 years, then is downgraded to detected, and then downgraded to inconclusive. Now that declassification isn't written into rule, and it's been a little bit of a moving target in the past on how we do that. So we'd like to write some declassification into rule so that we make ourselves fair to all waters across the state. So the new method that we've come up with the western region, with the 19 western states that I meet with, is the first classification would be suspect. That classification lasts for 3 years of testing negative, and then is downgraded to nothing. There is no step down. That way there's no confusion as to what exactly it is that we're finding in that reservoir. Each one of these classifications is based on a level of risk or a level of finding and confidence that there is something actually in the reservoir. So suspect would last for 3 years. It's our lowest level of suspicion there. Detected level would last for 5 years, at which point we would downgrade it to no classification. There's no step down again. And infested would last 7 years. And this declassification method, we want to write into rule. I'm going to go through and just kind of explain what each classification means and give you an example of a water body in Utah that it would apply to. So currently we use the detected or suspected label. Under the new system, we would call a water body suspect. If we go out and we sample, so our biologists, Richard Gibbs is here to answer some questions if needed. They go out and they sample all of the major water bodies at least once a year. They pull a net through the water column looking for what we call veligers, mussel veligers. That's the baby mussels that they release. There's a picture of it in the corner. If we pull a sample that has a veliger in it, we can visually observe that, and then we send it off to two different labs to confirm the genetic confirm with genetics that is in fact what we see, then we would classify it as a suspect water. An example of that under this new system would be Sand Hollow Reservoir. In 2010, we found a single adult mussel there. We did send it off to labs. It was confirmed that it was, in fact, an adult quagga mussel. However, since 2010, we haven't found any other visually observable mussels in that water body. Under this classification scheme, it would be called a suspect water. The next classification up, we don't currently have this in our rule, would be called detected. It lasts for 5 years. That would indicate that we go out and we sample two consecutive times and find mussels that we can visually see and send off for genetic analysis, and is confirmed by DNA. An example of this would be Lake Powell and what we saw last fall. We had several samples from us, from the Bureau of Reclamation, and from the National Park Service that all confirmed that there were quagga mussel veligers in the water. Because there were several consecutive samples of veligers, we would call that a detected sample. The last level, infested, which is certainly a level that we never want to see on any of our water bodies, would indicate that we go out and multiple times we sample multiple age classes of attached mussels. The reason we're going with attached mussels is that indicates that they can, in fact, reproduce in the water body. If we find the veligers, there's a pretty low chance that those take and start reproducing. But if we find them attached and we find several size classes, then we know that they are, in fact, reproducing in that water body, and we feel comfortable calling it infested. An example of that, again, would be Lake Powell, and what we saw this spring. We found several attached mussels at Antelope Point Marina and at Wawi Marina, and in several different sizes, different age classes, indicating that there is recruitment going on in that mussel population. So to kind of give you a rundown of this declassification and clarify it a little bit, there is light at the end of the tunnel if a water body comes up with mussels. Supposing, using Lake Powell as an example again, at some point in the future we pull samples and they come back negative for any quagga mussels. The time clock for the 7 years begins then. Until we come back with a negative, it would retain its infested classification and there would be no countdown as far as declassifying that water body. So with the first negative sample, the 7 year time clock begins. If at any point during that time we pull another sample that has mussels in it, the time clock would reset. Now we've also made some concessions in this rule rewrite for reservoirs or water bodies that can treat immediately and completely eradicate mussels. An example of that, although it's not too close to home here, would be Grantsville Reservoir by Tooele. It's a small irrigation reservoir that does get quite a bit of boat traffic. If they were to get a quagga mussel in their water body, they would be able to shut off the water, drain it completely, and treat it with chemicals or dry it out completely to kill everything in it before they refilled it. At that point, we'd probably classify it as a suspect water. It would go into our director's designation, and we would keep a good eye on that for 3 years to make sure that there is, in fact, nothing there. So what does this all mean for Utah water bodies? We've had four that have been on our blacklist for quagga mussels up until now. Lake Powell, because we found multiple size classes of adult mussels on several different occasions, it will retain its infested classification. Red Fleet Reservoir, just up the road, we found a single quagga mussel veliger 5 years ago. We have found nothing since. We would remove all classifications from Red Fleet Reservoir and all requirements of boaters to decontaminate their boats as they leave. Electric Lake, the same thing. We found a single zebra mussel veliger there 5 years ago. Nothing since. We would remove its classification. Sand Hollow Reservoir down in the southern region would be reclassified as a suspect water. It would go under our director's designation after that as to what he would like to do. It has sampled for 3 years without finding a physical mussel in the water body, and so we would probably remove its classification as well, leaving Lake Powell as the only water body in the state of Utah to be affected by quagga mussels, which is a good thing. That helps us so that we can focus our resources at the source of the problem and stop it there. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Do we have any questions from the public?
What?
Can I have you come up to the microphone and state your name, please, sir?
Del Brady here. I was on Lake Powell. What is the potential down the road? Because that could be serious.
It is very serious, and decontaminations across the state for boats leaving Lake Powell have skyrocketed. It's tripled this year because of Lake Powell. Lake Powell itself, we're not finding anything upstream of Antelope Point Marina. Everything is downstream, and in fact, everything that we've found is in Arizona. None of it's in Utah yet. However, a lake the size of Lake Powell is very difficult to treat. There's one example of a lake in New York where they were able to use divers to go and pluck all of the mussels off, and now they can't find mussels in there anymore. That's the only case that we've identified in the United States where they've been able to eradicate mussels in that way. And the Park Service seems to think that they can do that. So they've been sending divers down. To date, we found over 1,000 mussels in Lake Powell. I'm pretty confident that there's more there. We've even found them on the screw gates on the dam, unfortunately. Hopefully, with our efforts, we can hold them at bay, at least for a while, if not eradicate them, even though eradication doesn't seem incredibly promising.
Thank you. Any more questions? Yes, sir. Please come up to the microphone and state your name. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Ken Olson. You say 5 years ago you found them in Red Creek?
We did. We found a single quagga mussel belliger.
So why haven't you found them since? Have they been eradicated or what?
Yeah. You know, the way that quagga and zebra mussels reproduce, maybe I just need to explain a little bit of biology there. A quagga mussel, a female quagga mussel, can produce up to 40,000 belligers in a single event and up to 1 million in a year. The survival rate on those is extremely low. They are not very hardy when they're first released from a female. With the threat from the lower Colorado River and Lake Powell, I would guess that every single potable water in Utah has been exposed to mussels at some point, but their survivability is so low that they can't take off until it's been inoculated several times. A boater that has ballast water or live well water or water in their engine that goes into a lake that hasn't drained it and decontaminated it can dump belligers in there, and then we can by chance happen to sample them. That's why we have these lower classifications written in there, because it's a lower confidence that there's an actual breeding population there. Regardless of classification, we'll make boaters decontaminate their boats when they leave those water bodies, just to be sure that we're not spreading them anywhere. But because their survivability is so low, a single belliger doesn't mean that we necessarily have a major problem.
Any more questions from the public? Comments? Do you have any questions from the rec? Comments? Okay. What's that?
You're slipping.
I'm slipping? Why is that? No questions or comments? I actually have done extensive studies on this, on the quagga mussels themselves. In 2010, when they found the single one in San Jolo Reservoir, I kind of started looking into it myself, and it is potentially a catastrophe for the waterways and the water systems all the way down the Colorado, but that's either here or there. In that case, we should make a recommendation on the agenda item, given that we cannot make a vote. Do we have any recommendations currently?
Recommend that it goes forward as presented.
Does anybody have any negation to this? Okay. The Northeastern Region Regional Advisory Council would like to recommend that R657-60 on aquatic invasive species is accepted as presented by the state. That being said, we'll move on to apparently number 8 because we skipped number 7 on the agenda for R657-43 landowner permit rule amendments. Mr. Dax Mangus. How we roll.
Okay. This is the recommendation for a modification to this rule 67-43. What this recommendation does is allow for a certificate of registration and the associated variances to be valid for a 3-year period. for a landowner association application, similar to the way the CWMU process works now. When a CWMU submits their application, it's a three-year application. Currently, so it allow the landowner association to amend that application annually if there are changes in property ownership or if they change their bylaws or any of the other required components for a landowner association. It also allows the division to adjust permit numbers if the permit numbers that are issued through our limited entry process change, and we need to move permit numbers up or down. It gives the division flexibility to do that. And that's it. That's about the only changes to the rule that we're recommending at this time.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the public? Comments? Mr. Olson, I believe that this would probably fall on your comment card, right?
On the landowner association?
It's as close as I can call it on the
extended branch tree.
It's probably not the landowner.
No, it's going to be probably the wrong application for this particular comment. The wrong meeting for that. When would that meeting take place?
That would have been in
November. November's meeting is when that would have been discussed.
For now, what are you talking about?
For your comment on extended archery. We have to adhere to the agenda, and unfortunately this one doesn't qualify under what we're discussing this evening. So, but you're welcome to hang out after for a few minutes and talk with the region themselves regarding your question. Okay, sounds great. In that case, do we have any other comments from the public? Okay, questions from the rec?
I got one question. Each year we've been having a waiver for the Landowners Association. That would make that waiver every 3 years also, correct?
Yeah, I think you're referring to the variance request that Diamond Mountain makes. Yeah,
yep.
It would be when Diamond submitted their application, it would be for a three-year period, and the variance request would be for that same three-year period as well.
Any other questions? Comments? Okay, at this time, we need to make a recommendation regarding action item number 8.
I'll make that recommendation that we support the division on this.
Is there anyone opposed on the rec? Okay. The Northeastern Region would like to recommend that R657-43 on landowner permits, rule amendments, is accepted as presented. That being said, we'll move on to number 9, R657-10, Cougar rule amendments.
Okay. Dax Mangus, I'll be presenting this item as well. Basically, there's two components to the rule changes we're recommending here. The first is kind of some edits, some updates, some clarifications with definitions from some other rules that have changed. And the second part is a new depredation cougar permit. So just the first part. One of the things, the legal definition of immediate family member wasn't defined in the rule, but in a lot of our other rules, that is defined as a spouse, child, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, father, mother, father-in-law, mother-in-law, brother, sister, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, stepchild, grandchild. So we're adding that into this rule just to make it consistent with that definition of other rules. In this rule, let's see. There have been some changes to code with regard to firearms and can be used. This is how the rule is currently written, that a person can take cougar with a gun that can't be fired, fully automatic, bow and arrow, and a crossbow. The new rule would read that they could use a muzzleloader with a magnifying scope, a bow with draw locks, or a crossbow. And this is due to the recent change that was made last round of the RAC and Board meeting. We're on an any weapon hunt, a hunt where you could use any legal weapon, commonly referred to as the rifle hunt, because most folks use a rifle. But on the any weapon hunt, you could use a magnifying scope on a muzzleloader, use a draw lock on a bow, or use a crossbow. We don't have, archery only or muzzleloader only hunts for cougar, so it just opens the the door for folks to use different weapon types on a cougar hunt. And then another change there with just the clarifications and for consistency with other rules and state laws. It did read in the rule that a person with a pursuit permit, so not a hunting permit, but just the person that's doing pursuit of lions with dogs, couldn't carry a firearm with them. We're recommending that be struck from the rule. The division's concern was that people may be, you know, pursuing lions might actually kill one even though they're not permitted to do so. But because of firearms laws and state code, we're recommending striking that from the rule. The second part of the recommended rule change is the creation of a new livestock owner permit or a depredation permit for cougars. Currently, there is a 72-hour window if a livestock owner loses livestock or has a lion harassing or killing livestock, they can kill the lion. It's more difficult to kill a lion in the spring or summer when you don't have snow on the ground and the scent doesn't stay as long because of the temperatures. There are times when Wildlife Services, the federal agency, can't help the livestock permit or the livestock owners. And so there was discussion of a need for more proactive measures to allow livestock owners to remove depredating lions during the time of year when it made the most sense and was easiest to remove the lions. This is recommended to create a tool to help landowners be able to protect their livestock and help solve their own problems. The discussion and this recommendation arose after a lot of discussions that have been had at RAC meetings, and so that's why the division is recommending this time. The way the rule reads, would the division may, so we're not required to, but may issue a depredation permit to take cougar on specified private lands or public land grazing allotments that have a documented history of ongoing cougar depredation on livestock. The division may issue one or more depredation permits to the livestock owner or a designee if the livestock owner, for example, is an older person that could not go out and pursue the lion himself. They could designate that their nephew's going to go or something like that, as long as the designee does not receive monetary compensation. So it's not designed to create a financial incentive for people to want to take lions. And then the division has the ability to determine what weapons or method to take would be allowed and specify the areas and season that this permit would be valid. Any cougar taken with one of these depredation permits would have to be surrendered within 72 hours and would remain the property of the state. It's kind of a summary. So this would be a new permit for livestock owners to take cougars on specified areas. There would have to be a documented history of depredation. The division would determine the weapon type and the seasons and areas for this permit. And the livestock owner wouldn't be able to sell the permit or access, and the cougar would remain the property of the state. And so the intended or hoped for results would be that a livestock producer would be able to take cougar that are killing livestock during the time of year when it's easier to take lions, allow them to protect their animals. There isn't there could be lions taken that would not be the offended lions. So if we're issuing this permit to allow a permit holder to take lions in the winter, but they're losing animals during the summer, it's possible this permit holder could go out in the winter and kill a lion that wasn't the offending lion that's killing the livestock. So there, that's maybe one of the drawbacks of this permit. And that's the recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Mangus. Are there any questions from the public? Any comments? Questions from the rec?
Dax?
Yes, sir.
You talk about the spring and the summer, but a lot of allotments are fall and winter allotments when the lions are, could cause a depredation. So it's not all the allotments are just during the summer.
Yeah. We have pretty good luck in this region. I think the real motivation for this recommendation came from some of the other regions. In our region, most of our lion units are harvest objective units, and we have a pretty decent amount of pressure on our lions. And our wildlife services folks in this region have been pretty good with responding to livestock depredation issues. I don't foresee that this is something we would use a lot in our region, but I guess in some of the other regions they felt that they had a need for this tool. And we like to have the options to address these kind of problems if we have them, but I don't foresee us using it a lot in this region.
Dax, will this permit, if it is used, will it count towards the quota?
We have the discretion if we want to count it towards the quota or not. I talked to the program coordinator in Salt Lake, and I guess I haven't had that discussion with my biologist yet. Most of the units in our region, we're actually trying to reduce lions right now. So we would collect the information as far as age and sex of the lion and use that in our recommendation process. But right now, I don't think we'd count it towards our quota.
And if I understand, I know the Utah Hounds Mine Association was kind of against supporting this one, but the landowner doesn't necessarily get the carcass. The carcass stays to the state unless otherwise the state determines that it's okay to give it to them. Is that correct?
The way the rules are written, there's two ways a landowner or a livestock owner could potentially kill a lion. The one way is the 72-hour window, where within 72 hours of it occurring, they could kill a lion. If that's the case, and that's the way the rule is now, the division can choose to give the carcass of that lion to the livestock owner. This new permit, they don't have that option. They surrender the carcass of the division to the division. So and then under the way the rule is written now, you know, if they kill the lion within that 72-hour window and they decide to keep it, if they had another lion permit, they could not keep more than one lion in one season. But this permit, they would not be allowed to keep the lion under any circumstances. Is that the intent is not to create an additional hunting opportunity. The intent is to try to remove offending lions that may be killing livestock.
Define documented.
You know, we'll do an investigation, either a division personnel or wildlife services. Go and they look for canine tooth marks and broken neck, and you know, or a carcass that's pulled up under a tree and buried. You know, they'll go and conduct an investigation and determine whether or not they can confirm that it was a mountain lion kill. If it's something that was killed months before and there's not any, you know, distinguishing characteristics that indicate it would be a lion kill, then that wouldn't be documented as a lion kill.
If you have one confirmed lion kill, would that be enough to consider it documented?
In the rule, it says chronic. I think some of the terminology uses chronic and numerous. So I think one instance wouldn't classify as a chronic problem.
Repeated offender.
Yeah, it would be if you're having multiple instances in the same year, or if year after year, you know, a producer is losing animals year after year.
Okay. Any other questions from
the panel? Thanks. I'll just make the comment that, you know, a livestock owner, if he catches a lion harassing, warning his livestock, he doesn't even need this permit. He can shoot a lion.
He can. Under that 72-hour rule, if a livestock owner...
He has to see it being done, right?
Yeah, if a lion is harassing his animals, or he feels like his animals are threatened, or if it's killed an animal, a livestock owner currently has the right to...
They're not gaining anything new specifically. It's just the extension of how we could...
It does give the flexibility. Like the example I used was if someone had a summer permit and they consistently, you know, had a lot of sheep killed by lions or something on a summer permit, it would give the division the flexibility to issue them a permit to take a lion from that area, you know, during the fall or winter when it's easier to hunt lions and they're more likely to kill a lion. It's hard to run and kill a lion in the summer.
Yeah, I'm just making a point. Yeah. It's not something that the landowner's getting new, you know. So, thanks.
For clarification on the 72-hour provision, can a designee harvest the lion or shoot the lion?
Let me see. Now, we're not proposing changing that. I have a copy of the existing rule. In that, it says livestock owner, an immediate family member, or employee could take it. So that they would not have the option to appoint a designee to kill in that 72-hour type situation. And that's the way the rule currently is written.
Great. Any other questions or comments from the REC? Okay, at this point, we need to make a recommendation regarding this rule.
I'll make the recommendation to accept the Cougar Rule amendments as presented.
Do we have anyone opposed? Okay, the Northeastern Region Advisory Council would like to recommend that we move forward with R657-10 as presented by the state.
I just want to, before we shut down here, I want to thank you guys for coming and being here with a short agenda, an agenda that may seem like it wasn't as important as some of our other agendas. But as you can see, without having a full quorum, we don't get, our people in our region don't get much of a voice. And I mean, we can say, well, they recommended that this take place, but it takes away the voice of the people of the region. And I just want you to know I appreciate you coming out and taking this seriously and doing this and representing the people of this Great Basin area. And so that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Can I take this opportunity to disagree with you?
Sure.
That Action 8 and number 9 were pretty important items.
Yeah, but to some it may seem like it wasn't as important as some of the other items that we deal with. But yeah,
these two items, you know, yep, to me.
Oh, they're all important.
There's
we
a lot of
bring
items
them
here.
Action number 6 cost us millions of dollars.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Millions.
Yeah. So we needed 6.
Total.
6 total.
Counting you?
No.
So
we had 5. So
one more.
Yeah, we need one more. So, anyways, like I said, thank you very much. I appreciate your dedication.
Boy, I'm kind of new to this, but how often does this happen?
Not very often. This is the first time it's happened since I've been the regional supervisor. It's happened a few times before, off and on, but over the last 2 years, it hasn't happened.
These recommends, they still go to the state, don't they?
So
you know,
bring your friends. They're sitting next to you. Well, they should be sitting next to you. Thank you.
Okay, at this time, I'd like to call for a motion to adjourn the meeting.
I'll make that.
Okay. I'll second it.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Thank you, guys.